Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mike Prame and I represent the Alorica defendants. Today at council table is Elizabeth Lind, who represents Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley had joined in the petition and also has joined in the appeal of the class certification order.
All right.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We had identified 4 reasons why we thought the class certification order should be reversed. I'd like to start with the standing argument relative to the plaintiff's ability to pursue claims regarding investment options in which she did not personally invest. We believe that raises an Article III standing issue as recognized by 2 other circuit courts, the Second Circuit and the D.C. Circuit. Both found that because the plaintiffs in 401k plans were not personally injured with respect to the investments that they did not own, they could not pursue ERISA breach of fiduciary duty claims relative to those investments. In the Second Circuit and the Collins case, the plaintiffs were allowed to proceed with respect to 3 investment options in which they personally invested, but not others. In the Wilcox case, they were allowed to proceed as to 2 investment options in which they invested, but not a set of Vanguard funds. Decision by this court that aligns with the Second Circuit and the D.C. Circuit would also be consistent with the court's prior guidance in Dorman. Dorman is another case dealing with 401k plans and underperforming investment options. And there, this court recognized that these types of claims for breach of fiduciary duty are inherently individualized. And I think it's just a natural extension of that ruling to conclude that someone can, because these are inherently individualized, they really should only be allowed to pursue claims and have standing to pursue claims regarding the investment options in their own 401k account.
So what about the Melendres opinion from our circuit that talks about standing relative to an individual's injury, but moving some of those issues over to class certification and typicality?
Thank you, Judge Jansen. That was the next item on my agenda as well. Melendez is, I think, there's 2 ways to approach standing here. One, we think straight up this court could rule that because we have so different circumstances relative to the investment options in which these plan participants have, that they lack standing as to others. Alternatively, you could apply Melendez, apply the class certification analysis, and look to the typicality arguments that we make in our brief and say, well, under the class certification approach, they lack typicality with respect to the claims alleged for breach of fiduciary duty as to the other investment options.
Haven't other circuits applied Melendres in the context of ERISA claims?
I'm not aware of other courts applying Melendez. If you look at the Second Circuit's decision in Northeast Grocers case, they also looked at class standing under a class certification approach, and they rejected it. The Second Circuit said the plaintiff still failed to demonstrate an invasion of their rights relative to the investment options, even though they claimed that the same flawed decision-making process affected every investment. So I think we have another circuit that has also addressed class certification analysis relative to these types of claims where we're talking about other investment options.
What about standing under the record-keeping theory, which seems to contemplate plan-wide behavior?
In terms of the record-keeping, a slightly different analysis. You'll recall before the district court, there was initially an allegation of a $40 reasonable record-keeping fee. And then the defendants went back to the plaintiffs and said, well, your 2 plaintiffs, they paid $6 and $39. So they paid less than the reasonable record-keeping fee. Therefore, they have not been injured. Plaintiffs came back and said, well, we're going to change that $40 to an asset-based fee. And we're going to apply that asset-based fee to all the plan participants. What we maintain with respect to standing at the class certification stage is that once we move past the pleading stage where this initial conversation occurred, it was incumbent upon the plaintiffs at the class certification stage to establish that reasonable fee, that $40 that was the initial starting point by preponderance of the evidence. And they didn't do that. They relied upon their allegations. And we, in fact, went back to the district court and said, well, even if you look at the documents that the plaintiffs had incorporated by reference in their complaint, those documents show not that $40 is a reasonable fee, but 75% of the plans the same size as the Alorica plan.
But that seems to be more, factual discussions. Isn't it sufficient for the plaintiffs to say we overpaid for a record keeping and so have other class members, and so there's injury as a result of that?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. At the class certification stage, the court needs to undertake a rigorous analysis, and they need to be able to, just like you would have in employment law cases, you put in evidence to support your violation. They did not do that here. There's no evidence to support their $40 starting point. We do believe that there's still a standing issue with respect to the record-keeping fee. With respect to the record-keeping fee, I think actually the more significant issue really relates to the interclass conflict, that when they applied this asset-based fee across all the plan participants, it resulted in these two plan participants paying less than the $60 and the $39 that they originally paid. But it caused 35 to 52% of the remaining plan participants to pay more.
Would you address whether the district court erred in its typicality analysis by focusing on the record-keeping component and not what I'll call the investment component?
We do believe that there is a typicality issue with respect to the investment performance that needed to be further addressed by the district court. And we lay that out as the second basis, connected also with Melendrez, as to why class certification should be reversed here. And the typicality component, in our view, is an investment by investment analysis. And plaintiff's proofs with respect to their own two investment options is not going to advance the claims relative to the dozens of other investment options in which they're pursuing their claims here in this case.
Because I think the argument can reasonably be made that there is typicality when it comes to the record-keeping side, but on the other side, the investment side, that just seems to be a lot of individual decisions to me that I don't see how that can even be a class action, frankly.
And Your Honor, on appeal here, we are only challenging typicality as to the investments. We're not challenging typicality as to the record-keeping fee.
But you said the district court did not address the typicality analysis on the investment side.
On the investment side, we think that the court erred in finding typicality.
The district court did address typicality on the investment side?
It did, but briefly. Mm-hmm. And what we think where the error lies is both on some of the same issues you were just talking about in the prior case, and that when you have an ERISA breach of fiduciary duty claim, you have two elements. You have whether there was a breach, and then you have loss causation. And typicality for the breach element is going to look at, well, the process issues. What did the different plan fiduciaries do over time to review and monitor the investment options? And here we have different people looking at different investment options over time. Moreover, we have different factors being applied to different investment options. Plan fiduciaries do a different analysis with respect to, for example, a stock fund or a fund that would have alternative investments or cryptocurrency in it than they would in analyzing a money market fund, which has a much different investment profile and risk associated. So there's not a one-size-fits-all to the breach element in terms of process. And then you move over to this separate element that was being discussed earlier about loss causation. And that also is investment by investment. It requires an analysis of the challenged investment, often to a peer group or to a set of other appropriate indices or other investment options available in the marketplace. And plaintiff's evidence with respect to their two investment options is going to be vastly different than the other dozens of investment options in which they're now pursuing these claims in this lawsuit. Unless the court has any other question, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Good Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christina Humphrey on behalf of the plaintiffs appellees. This case has one common factual predicate that gives rise to all of plaintiffs' claims. You may have noticed that the certified class period ends on December 31st, 2022. That is the same date that all of the challenge funds that are listed in the plaintiff's Second Amendment complaint were replaced, and that's also the same date that revenue sharing was completely eliminated from the plan. Now, you may have read that the record reflects that there was no investment committee for part of the class period, really until 2018. The beginning of the class period is 2016. There was no investment committee. Because there was no investment committee, there was no monitoring of the investments. There was no monitoring of Morgan Stanley, who was the investment advisor on the plan. 90% of the shares were in revenue-sharing share classes, and because Morgan Stanley was compensated by a revenue-sharing scheme, the district court correctly held that the plaintiffs' and participants' injuries were closely tied to Morgan Stanley's actions.
Counsel, could you briefly address the, or not so briefly, address the standing issue?
So with respect to the Article III standing?
Yes. More specifically, standing to sue on behalf of funds in which the plaintiffs were not invested.
Sure. So basically the point that I'm trying to make is I think this all goes back to LaRue. So LaRue is quoted by the defendants. The Dorman case is quoted by the defendants. But what Dorman held is that individualized injuries are not distinct from plan injuries. Now, in that case, the Supreme Court held that a individual account can bring a claim under 502A2 for fiduciary breaches to that impair the plan's assets as to a specific account.
So, counsel, what language are you relying upon in Dorman? What's the language? What's the citation for that case? Is that the unpublished disposition?
The LaRue decision?
Oh, I thought you said Dorman.
Oh, the Dorman decision. That's another issue.
Okay, so what case are you saying supports the proposition that individuals may sue on behalf of plans on which they have not invested? What case are you relying upon for that proposition?
So that's not necessarily the proposition. I'll tell you this.
But this is my question to you,
sure.
Counsel.
Understood.
Is there a case that says a plaintiff may sue on behalf of a fund in which he or she has not invested? Is there a case that says that?
Yes, the Third Circuit Bully versus Universal.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so sorry, I didn't understand your question. But yes, the Bully versus Universal addressed this very same issue and employed a similar analysis to what was in Melendres. So essentially, the district court in our case applied a similar analysis, basically stating that once you establish individual Article III standing, you turn to a Rule 23 typicality analysis.
Counsel, let me ask you: did you cite the? You say Boeing.
Boley, Boley.
Boley. Did you cite that in your brief?
I don't know without looking. I apologize.
I don't see it cited there.
Okay. So that was an oversight on our part if it's not.
Okay.
Okay. So basically, the question that was posed earlier is, did the court assess the typicality analysis? And it did. It held that because their claims arise out of the same course of conduct, the claims were therefore typical. And it relied on Melendres, and it also held, well, if you're looking at the factual circumstances of Melendres, I think it, number one, it seems to hold that what the defendants are saying is that each claim of the plaintiffs must be exactly identical. I think we all know that that's not what the case necessarily hold in the Ninth Circuit. If you look at the facts of Melendres, there were different factual circumstances of the named plaintiffs versus the absent class members. Some of them underwent saturation patrols, other routine patrols, but the Ninth Circuit held that regardless of those factual circumstances, the representative plaintiffs were adequate and they didn't pose a significantly different set of concerns. Now, that is the same standard that applies in this case. So the defendants talk about benchmarks, and there's been a lot of discussion about benchmarks today. There's no question that
the counsel, can I interrupt just to stick with typicality? I'm looking at the district court's order at ER 16 to 18, and it seems to be wholly related to a discussion about the record keeping and not anything having to do with whether plaintiffs are typical of other class members if they've invested in different funds. So where was the district court analyzing the issue that you said it analyzed?
Sure, I can get the specific quote for you. I don't have it offhand, but what I can say is that the court expressly concluded that you didn't have to have a different plaintiff for each different investment fund.
But that's talking about for standing.
Okay.
Right? And so even if that's the case, you still have a different analysis for typicality.
Sure.
And I take it your friends on the other side's argument is that the district court at a minimum should have analyzed whether these plaintiffs are typical of other plaintiffs who may not have invested in the same funds that they did, you know, in order to defeat class certification. And I don't see any analysis about typicality on as to that issue.
Okay. Well, the district court did do that if you look carefully at the opinion, because it
first came where? Let me
get it for you. Sorry.
Tell us the excerpts of record page that you're looking at.
Okay, 16.
Okay, what line are you referring to?
So we're looking at typicality under lines 9 through 20.
ER 16, lines 9 to 20. So that's the law on typicality.
Yes. So
that applied.
Just a moment. I have to reread this, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
The only thing I see is line 25 going over to line to page 17, lines 1 to 2. It says, the Rogers Declaration shows that when converted to base points, both Munoz and Olson were paying higher fees than they would have paid under $40 per capita fee structure. Is there anything else?
I would have to take a closer look at it, Your Honor.
All right.
My understanding is that it did. He cites Ellis versus Costco for structure in addition to the Melendrez case. I understand the section you're looking at evaluates record-keeping fees. My recollection is that there was one, it wasn't a deep analysis, but basically it say that all the injuries tie back to the fiduciary misconduct the plaintiffs are alleging, which is really a failure to monitor because there was a failure to have a committee and any real oversight of the plan.
And you may be right, and you know, however that shakes out, but I think what the panel's reacting to is that there wasn't the proper analysis by the district court on a typicality argument that was raised by the other side and would seem to be pretty pertinent to these claims. I mean, similarly, I don't really see an analysis on the adequacy side related to the class conflict issue.
Sure. Well, that's based on the fact that the court held that the defendant's entire theory is based on a misreading of the Second Amendment complaint. The conflict itself is not an actual conflict, so there was nothing to rule on. The plaintiff's theory is not that each participant should pay an annual record keeping of $40, and he says that's what we've alleged from the beginning. It's a misreading. So what the plaintiffs have actually alleged, that $40 should be charged per participant to the plan as a whole, and then that should be distributed to the participants based on their account balances.
Well, then that still would raise the same adequacy argument and maybe an intra-class conflict, because if some people are paying less than $40 now, they don't want to pay $40. They don't want somebody to represent them to the end that they have to pay $40 if they're paying $6 now. So
just to clarify, that's not the theory. The theory is not $40. We're not saying that everybody has to pay $40 annually. That's not it. We're saying that the $40 should be charged to the plan as a whole. So you multiply it by the number of participants, and that's what the plan as a whole should pay for record keeping services. Then that is translated into basis points, which is how the accounts, the plan structure is, the fee structure is right now.
But some people might not want that. Some people might not want that. They may want to keep the structure that they have if it results in less. And so without analyzing what effect that would have or how that affects each of the relative classes, subclasses, if you will, that's difficult to say that it's adequate or that there's typicality there.
Sure, but Rogers did do that in his declaration. And Schedule B of his declaration shows that there's plan-wide overpayment of $1.2 million that impacts every participant in
the
plan.
But did the district court rely on that, though, in its analysis?
Sure, it did. The framework analysis.
You say sure very glibly, but...
No, it did. It cited the Ellis versus Costco case sets forth the standard for weighing expert evidence at the class certification stage. It denied plaintiff's motion to strike based on Daubert, but it didn't end there. It weighed the criticisms of Rogers' analysis. They took his deposition. They submitted all the deposition testimony. It weighed the evidence that was submitted in support of the $40 benchmark, which at this stage of the litigation is only a preponderance of the evidence. We had submitted the NEPC survey, which they criticized, and the court considered.
There is a brief reference at ER 20 that although the Alorica defendants pose that Munoz and Olson have an irreparable conflict with absent class members, relying on the fact that they each paid less than $40 in record-keeping fees, the court does not find that there's an actual class conflict that is created in this instance. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. And so this court is held in Blackie versus Barrick and the Cummings case that conflicts can't be based on speculation. And here there isn't an actual conflict to rule on. Therefore, there is no conflict. It's been manufactured by the plaintiffs based on a theory that we never alleged.
If we conclude that the typicality analysis is not comprehensive enough, what's your view on whether under Black Lives Matter, this court's precedence, and that Judge Rawlinson wrote the opinion, whether that requires a remand?
Specifically, I'm not sure I understand your analysis. I've got my head stuck in Melendrez.
Okay.
So I apologize.
That's right. I'll let you have the rest of your time for whatever you want to argue.
So what I would say with respect to the different investments, it seems that the court seems to understand the theory that it's all tied to the same plan-wide fiduciary misconduct. In my view, the court did employ the correct analysis and did a full analysis and understood that it's all tied to the failure to monitor. And it's self-evident from the complaint because they replaced all the plans replaced all of the challenge funds December 31st, 2022, and eliminated revenue sharing. So as far as typicality, it all ties back to the same breach, same causation, and if each individual participant were to bring their own claims under LaRue, even though it's a plan-wide, or even though it's a plan injury, they would all be alleging the same breaches. They would be all alleging that there was a failure to form a committee, failure to monitor the investments. And so therefore, I'm almost out of time. We believe, Your Honor, that the district court met its standards and evaluated the preponderance of the evidence under Rule 23A, Article 3, and typicality. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you. There are 2 points I'd like to raise. The first is on this concept of whether there was a breach related to the failure to form a committee. We do lay this out in our brief that there is a, that we believe is a false premise to begin with, and that ERISA allows individuals to serve as decision makers. And the plaintiffs here, in fact, sued the people who were making the decisions prior to the committee in 2018. So you do have fiduciaries in place during this entire time period. There's no requirement under ERISA that it be conducted through a committee process as opposed to individual employees. Regardless, even if plaintiffs were pursuing this theory about the absence of a committee, then you would have their claims cabined to the period prior to the formation of the committee in 2018. They don't do that. Their complaint and their proceedings in this case seek to challenge investment decisions after the formation of the committee in 2018 and different investment options that were added and removed during that time period. So there's a disconnect between this theory of the absence of a committee and the nature of their claims, which underscores that we're looking at an investment by investment analysis as well. And as the Second Circuit recognized in the Collins case, the court said there, well, if you are pursuing a plan-wide violation, then you really should be suing with respect to all plan investment options. And that's not what is happening here. They definitely have brought claims relative to a large number of them, but a plan-wide misconduct claim regarding investments should involve all plan investments, and that's not here. So I do think that this committee issue is a bit of a red herring. We're really looking at whether there were individuals or a committee that and the process those people were undertaking over time to review and monitor the investment options.
Counsel, are you familiar with the decision from the Third Circuit Bowley cited by opposing counsel?
We had not looked at that, Your Honor,
that's
in preparation.
That's fair.
For this, we're happy to submit supplemental briefing on that.
Unless we ask you to. Thank you.
Sure. And then the last point I wanted to touch on was going back to this concept of whether the adequacy for the record-keeping claim and whether the court had analyzed the interclass conflict. And I appreciated Judge Sanchez's pointing out that section of the analysis in the court's opinion. When you look at that section of the court's opinion, it's talking about whether or not somebody paid more than $40. That wasn't our argument. Our argument before the district court was you had an interclass conflict because the way the plaintiffs were putting forth their theory of injury for themselves put them in conflict with a large portion of the class members. It wasn't whether or not it was $40 or not. So we do think that the district court didn't fully address the issue that we were presenting to it on the conflict. Unless the court has any further questions, we respectfully request that the district court order be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. That completes our calendar for the morning and for the week. We are adjourned.